Welcome everyone, this is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. It was a great privilege this week to meet the executive head teacher of Petten Primary School in Kent, Babish Daisel, who's originally from the Netherlands, and for many years she lived and worked in Zimbabwe and then Botswana. We learned that in Zimbabwe she studied the economic impact of projects run by a women's group. And she discusses the way in which one doesn't always realise how bad things are in a country, which she discusses is very different from the country where she got married, until one steps outside of it. She talks about her experience of living in houses surrounded by barbed wire and her friends being attacked. Born in The Hague, Babish talks about experiences which have made her and her family stronger. We talk about the ways in which we are inclined to look back through the past through a rose-coloured lens, but in which there were adversities we had to overcome. We talk about how boundaries were woolly during lockdown. She remembers from childhood driving to Spain or Italy and listening to Joe Cocker, Eric Clapton and Van Morrison on a loop and enjoying the sounds of Radio Caroline. In those days, there was information to which we did not have access, which is all very different to today, and we learn that Babish brought all of her records back with her from Zimbabwe to Botswana, but that they didn't make it to the UK. We find out how Babish ended up accidentally working as a teacher. When she was young, she wanted to be a ballerina. She studied social educational care at undergraduate level and then did a master's in pedagogy. When she was in Africa, she ended up working in the fashion industry as a menswear buyer. She talks about the reasons that she left that profession and then embarked on a teaching degree through the University of South Africa. Babish talks about why it's important for a teacher to have a broader experience than just what happens in the classroom. Teachers who are parents themselves also have a better understanding of the job. We discover whether there are any teachers who especially inspired her, and we talk about why it can be easier to be a teacher than it is to be a pupil. We talk about teaching in situations which we couldn't anticipate, how children will always tell the truth, and at the end of the interview, we discuss whether it is possible to find good experiences out of horrendous times. And we talk about how we used to be in touch with people in the days before social media. It was an enormous privilege for this week's nostalgia interview to catch up with Babish Daisel. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is my great pleasure to have Babish Daisel for my latest nostalgia interview. You're the head teacher at the school where four of my children go. But and just for the context, of course, there was an African theme at the school a few months ago. And I thought, I think that you'd be the dream interviewee because, of course, your background is living and working in Zimbabwe.
Yes, yeah. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So do you want to say a little bit about your background? So, because, of course, we're sitting in Petten, yes, in beautiful Kent in the middle of summer. But I think there's probably a good sort of sense of counterpoint in your life in terms of where you are now and where you were a decade or two ago.
Yes. So, yeah, I'm Babish. And originally I'm Dutch. So I grew up in the Netherlands and I moved to Zimbabwe in 1995, when I was 26, yeah, because my husband is from there, and lived there for quite a few years until the political situation there got so dangerous and it was impossible to live there. So we moved to Botswana for 4 years, and then we came to the UK and I ended up here.
But how did that journey start in terms of going to Africa? Because you're the second person I've interviewed in the last year who has spent a lot of time in the same region of Africa. And I'm thinking also in terms of HIV being rife. I'm thinking in terms of the political and economic instability. I mean, in terms of a life story, you've probably got more in 10 years or so than that you were there than many people would have in a lifetime.
Yeah, probably. So in the Netherlands, I did my master's degree in pedagogy, but with a side study on empowerment of women. And I went to Zimbabwe to do a research in the rural areas to see the impact, the economic impact of projects that were run by women's groups like the YWCA. So that's how I ended up in Africa. Stayed there for quite a bit longer than anticipated because I met my husband there. Came back to the Netherlands and finished my degree, and then went back to Africa. At that point, Zimbabwe was still very much a wealthy country, breadbasket of the world, they called it, with a very luxurious lifestyle. But slowly but surely, with farm invasions, Mugabe regime, that started slowly to fall apart.
Looking at it from the outside, I mean, I remember particularly in that period in the end of the 2000s when there was there were clearly issues there to deal with, being beaten up, and it was very obvious what had gone on there.
People died very suddenly.
And it's really interesting because, you know, when you're watching something on the news, when you're listening to this, you're thinking, oh, this is horrendous, and you can't get your head around it until you meet real people who've been there and experienced that. Because at least on the news sometimes, you can be desensitized. You're aware that there's something here which feels so out of kilter with what we're used to in the West. But in your case, you were living through that. I mean, you must have had family back home who were really frightened for you.
Yeah, they were very frightened and very worried. Yeah. When you're living in it and through it, you don't realize how bad it actually is until you step out of it and see it from the outside, and then you go, oh my goodness, I can't believe that we did all that. But we lived in houses surrounded by walls and barbed wires, but you would hear gunshots in the night and, you know, friends who'd been robbed or at gunpoint, beaten up.
Yeah, and when you look back on that period now, do you sometimes wonder what's happened to the people who were there? Are you in contact with some of the people that you were there? Or is it the case that it was almost like pressing that reset button and relocating and not being able, perhaps, to be able to establish those contacts and friendships?
Most of the people that, you know, friends and family, they have all left. There are very few people that are still there. And in contact, you know, via Facebook and things like that. And they somehow seem to be able to carry on the lifestyle that they used to have, and it's little pockets of security.
It's an interesting motif, and you see it in films. You know, the dream, the paradise, the Wizard of Oz is a great example of this allure of the other. And it's, I suppose, all the Shirley Valentine sort of example of the holiday that you want to last forever. But, of course, in reality, you know, the idea that the geographical place is going to change you, in reality, it's how you change yourself in relation to that place. But in your case, obviously going there without anticipating that all these horrendous things would happen, there must be the sense of unfinished business.
No, I think, because we stayed for a very, very long time. Most of our friends had already left by the time we eventually said, you know what, this is not for us anymore. And I've got a bit the feeling, you know, been there, done that, I've got the t-shirt, I don't want to go back. We did have to go back, we'd already been in Botswana for quite a few years. We needed to go back to get a new birth certificate for the boys. That was quite a horrendous experience. And already in that time, things had changed so much. The country where, you know, where I went when I got married, and the country where my kids grew up, and where my husband grew up, that country doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. Yeah. It's completely gone.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking in terms of going back even, you know, further, in terms of things like earliest memories growing up, because one of my colleagues at work is Dutch, and it's fascinating, and it was actually really funny talking to him about how his father was a big like music promoter, and he was talking about going to see Lionel Richie and Tina Turner, and I'm thinking, God, you know, you've done things that, you know, I could only dream of, but in your case, sort of growing up, what are the sort of earliest memories that you remember from childhood?
That was in the Netherlands. I remember, because I was born in The Hague, which is quite a, you know, big city. And when I was six, we moved to the north, to the countryside. And I remember going to school, primary school, and we moved to Friesland. And Friesland is the only province in the Netherlands. They speak their own language. And going to school and in the playground, not having a clue what anyone was saying, because I couldn't understand what they said, because they spoke Frisian. But I learned later on, and eventually most people just ended up just speaking Dutch. But that was the first thing. I'm still in the same country. I can't understand a word anyone says.
No, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes, those experiences, because you're forced into having to do things differently, you can overreach. You can, I mean, in my case, it's hardly the same, because although I don't speak Welsh, I'm from Wales, but there is that sense sometimes of childhood experiences. There's that sense of, well, why am I not connecting? Why am I not able to get on with everybody? Why are there certain clusters that I don't feel I belong to? But then you kind of look back and you think, but actually, in terms of where I am in my life now, that's almost been the spur to move forward.
Yeah, I think lots of the things that we've experienced as a family have made us really strong, and, you know, what doesn't break you makes you stronger, that type of thing. In Zimbabwe, the saying is, a boer maak 'n plan, a farmer makes a plan. If something went wrong, we dealt with it and we just carried on, and there was always a solution somewhere. We went through whole stages where there was no food, we had no running water, there was no electricity. Things were really, really tough, but again, you make a plan, you pull through. We had a whole barter economy going on. I think what's come out of it is that, you know, there is always a solution somewhere along the line.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because in a more, well, compared to what you just outlined, a far more sort of pedestrian example, but, you know, this is the week of the A-level, and also, for that matter, the GCSE results.
Yes.
And it's just so interesting, because it's exactly 30 years since I got my A-levels, and you think of all the horror and the fear and the anxiety about what the future has in store. But then you look back and say, oh, what was I worried about? But the reason I mention that is because it changes your perception of the past. Because it worked out okay, you know, it was all right on the night, as it were, then therefore you think, oh, actually, I overcame that adversity. Or maybe it wasn't really an adversity, it was just a little bit of apprehension. But if you keep a diary or something, then often you start to say, well, actually, my record at the time, you know, was this. And that's like an authentic account which, looking back over 30 years and revisiting in the light of today, can never quite give you. But do you have any of those sort of experiences or ways of renegotiating the past?
I think I don't keep a diary. I used to when I was younger, and you read it back and it's so toe-curlingly awful that I don't do that. I don't keep a diary. And I do think you look back on the past with, you know, coloured lenses, because, yeah, you came through it and it's okay. But we've had some really, really scary and awful times. My children were small and they would be playing in the garden. I mean, they had a fantastic life growing, because they didn't have any idea of what was going on. And we had the great outdoors, and we'd go see animals, and we'd camp in the wild and all sorts of things. But it was also, well, please make sure when you climb the tree, you don't fall out, because if you break your arm, we actually can't go to hospital.
Yeah.
A bit similar to now with the pandemic, I suppose. Where it was, you know, if you can avoid going to the hospital, you must. And it was the case there.
Yeah, no, actually, that's a good analogy, actually, because it's that very odd experience where everybody is in it together, when everybody, there's like things like Christmas sometimes, you know, it's all like everybody, whether you're a Christian or otherwise, you're all sort of celebrating something that's discernibly in common. But during the pandemic, everyone is in the same sort of state of alienation together. And in a strange way, it brings people together, albeit, of course, ironically, paradoxically brings them together, because actually they're not allowed to be together. But you find other means.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I found, that the resilience is actually really quite overwhelming.
Yes, and for us, Christmas in the pandemic was very similar to our normal Christmas, because there's four of us, and it's just us in the UK. Our families are spread all over the world. My family is in the Netherlands. My husband's family is all in South Africa now. So it is always just the four of us. So for us, it didn't make much of a difference, funnily enough. But
And I think that also that's the funny bit, that so many people found that they were actually able to spend more time with people. I mean, for good and ill, of course, because sometimes, you know, it's like, actually, you don't necessarily, you know, expect or want to do that every day. But yes, it has completely sort of recalibrated our sort of sense of what is home, and home as both a sort of a physical geographical place and also maybe a mental space, or the home, of course, and in your case, because you've got the Netherlands and you've got Africa, but the home not even of the imagination, but it was very real. But it's very much something that at one point was very real and very powerful, and now you're looking through a different sort of lens, yeah, in terms of where you are now.
As I say, for us, things didn't really change all that much, yeah, during the pandemic. Yeah. We all worked, so life went on as normal. It's just the roads were very quiet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And school was very quiet, yeah, because we only had certain kids in.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really good point, because it was a bit surreal even going around Canterbury and seeing so many, yeah, people out.
Yes.
Not so much in the first lockdown, when it was like a ghost town, but in the second. But you're right. But also there were things that you would just normally do. Like you'd think, oh, I'll go to the cinema or I'll do this. But you can't go to work, but you might be able to go to an outdoor play area or something. So you're sort of thinking, well, normally you've got five or six choices. Now you're down to one or two. But you invest more into those one or two.
Yeah, but we found, because we all worked. Mm. So normally we would work, and then on the weekends or in the evenings we'd go and do some nice, yeah, things. Yeah. Now we worked, and then we came home, and we couldn't do any of the nice things. Yeah. That was the only change for us.
Did you find you were doing more work in that sense?
Yes. But
yes, yeah, the same, yeah, here. Yeah,
yeah.
The boundaries were all lost.
Yeah, and I think as a head teacher, your boundaries are already quite, yeah, woolly. Yeah. Do a lot of work in the evenings and on the weekends, and it just stretched. Because I think the first couple of weeks of the first lockdown, I was working mostly from home. I had to go into isolation for 10 days very early on. Mm. Yeah, and work and life was completely fluid.
Yeah.
Trying to stop that a bit now.
Yeah, no, well, hats off to you, because I certainly found in lockdown that it was actually harder, because people were saying to me things like, oh, you know, you haven't got the commute now, so you must have more time. That's actually, no, actually, I felt even more squeezed, because you're doing things in a different environment, and you're having to negotiate that environment and pretend it's your work environment. And for the purposes of, in my case, online teaching, you know, if you're in your children's bedroom or something, then you realise that actually, you know, you have to put yourself into a different mental, yeah, space so you can do the job.
Yeah, I found, because normally I wake up at 6, yeah, and you know, quick look through my email, see if anything's come in. So I did that during lockdown. So, yeah, I would start working at 6, yeah, and then before I knew it was 9 o'clock, and then, yeah, I felt, oh, no, I really have to be on my computer just, yeah, in case someone needs, yeah, to see me. Yeah. I need, yeah, to be, otherwise I think,
yeah,
I'm not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you end up just, yeah, I found out I had less time when I was working from home, yeah, than when I, yeah, work at school.
Yeah.
And, very odd.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, going back to some of the sort of early memories, I mean, in my case, the thing that I define my childhood by is the music from the time. And it's very interesting, because as well as a diary, I kept lots of, it was probably deeply illegal, I don't know, but recording off the radio, and, you know,
we all do that. Yes.
But doing that, but I kept all the tapes, and I digitised them a few years ago. So, of course, whenever I listen in the car, maybe that's why I like my commuting, because I'm in that sort of space of, you know, and it's a good memory test. You think, that was March 1981 or whatever it might be, and you can sort of, you know, everything sort of fits together. But in your case, was there anything maybe to do with music or film, anything that you particularly remember, anything that sort of is a particular highlight of that period of your life?
Well, in childhood, growing up, I remember distinctly driving with my family, with my mom and my stepdad, stepsister and my brother. We would drive to Spain or Italy every holiday. Yeah. And my stepdad used to play these tapes of, and they had Joe Cocker, yeah, Eric Clapton, Van Morrison, yeah, on and on and on a loop. And it used to drive me insane, because it was just too much. Now, of course, who do I listen to?
Joe Cocker,
Van Morrison, Eric Clapton, yeah, a whole range of other artists as well. But they really grew on me. But I remember just sitting there thinking, and this was in the 80s,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I want to listen to other things. I want to listen to Depeche Mode, yeah, and Simple Minds, yeah, and The Cure. Yeah. And stuff.
Yeah.
Nope. And I still listen to those, yeah, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is interesting, isn't it, when you've got those dual sort of growing up experiences, because for me, you know, very early 80s, when I was like 7 or 8, I have very distinct memories of listening to the charts and Top of the Pops on the television. And yet my dad's music was also far more of a formative influence, perhaps, than I realised at the time, because that's also the stuff I listen to now. So if you listen to like a radio programme, I don't know, Pick of the Pops or something, yeah, and they're doing like a 1959 chart and 1981 chart. The 59 chart is when he was young. The 81 chart was when I was, well, much younger in my case than he was in 59. But the two together is like a complete composite. And it can be overwhelming, because suddenly you realise all the life stories, and it takes you back to all those conversations and family gatherings and even watching the record, you know, in the old days when you actually have the physical object going around the turntable.
Oh, yes.
But if in your case it was the car, what about things like radio? Did that play a role?
Yes, I had a radio. Yeah. I saved up for that pocket money, and you could put a tape in it, and you could record. So yeah, you would be sitting listening and trying to get the DJ not in your song, which was very difficult. And listen to things like Radio Caroline.
Yes.
And every evening when we were eating, my dad would have the top charts. This was in the Netherlands, obviously. Yeah. The top charts on. Always listened to what was on. And we had an equivalent of Top of the Pops. It was called Top Pop, I think. Yeah. Watched that. I think that was on a Sunday, religiously.
And one of the things I find so funny is when you can watch all of these programmes, and obviously YouTube can throw up all things, but also on BBC4, I think it is, when they show all these old programmes.
Yes.
And it's very disconcerting.
It's so dated.
It's so dated, but you realise, you know, that because you don't think of yourself as, you know, think of yourself as being the same person, and you think, oh, you know, and the same excitement sometimes. You think, I remember when Human League were number one, or whatever it might be. But then you look at photographs of yourself from that period, or even is it some of the presenters or the acts on the programme, and there's that real sense of displacement. And I wonder sometimes whether, you know, some things are best left to the imagination, because it can be really disconcerting when you've got a very real clear sense of who you were and what you remember. But when you look at yourself, what's thrown into stark relief is the fact that, you know, you're just a child, or you're the same age as your own children were in those days. And I joke with my children about how, you know, when I was their age, I was doing X and Y. And of course, they give me the look like, you know, you're weird, or you're very old.
Yeah.
You know, that's way before my time. But yes, so it sounds like you had some similar kind of experiences.
Yes, and my son is very much into his music, and he argues with me about certain artists and then tells me things about them that I really didn't want to know, because I think Eric Clapton is an anti-vaccine. That's really put me off. David Bowie is another person I really admire, and then my son says, but he's done this and that and that. I don't want to know that, because now you've sort of tainted the music.
Yeah, I think you're right, because in those days there would be like magazines, like Smash Hits comes to mind, where it was like 35p, and my pocket money would go towards that.
Yeah.
And you'd read in there. That was the go-to place. I think they also used to put the lyrics of songs as well.
Yes.
But nowadays, because I used to like even write down the charts and all sorts of stuff. But these days, because it's all, you don't need to do that, because it's all available online, and it takes away some of the magic. But of course, to children growing up now, to my children, because they didn't grow up in the days when everything was physical rather than virtual. You didn't have anything, you know, didn't have computers, mobile phones, or anything. Then, in a way, it's easy to look back and say, oh, those were simple times, because you didn't at the time know they were simple, because you had nothing to compare it with, apart from your own parents' generation, who might have grown up in the war, for example. And so in that case, they had a very different sort of set of expectations. But it is funny to sort of look at your own biography through the lens of your own children, or by the same token, your own parents.
Yeah, I think then, say things were simpler in the effect that there was just so much information we did not have access to. But now for children, it's so overwhelming. Everything's out there. And at the touch of a button, they know everything, and they're expected to know everything, and they're expected to know what's real and what's not real, and what is a true story and what isn't. And I think that's so challenging.
You must find that in the school context as well, because obviously, well, I would imagine most of them are too young to have phones. But I was going to say, But what's really interesting is the way in which people, and, you know, children know how to do things and can do things and can access information, which, you know, I mean, if you wanted to know those things in the past, you'd have to, in many cases, make a physical trip to a library look up stuff. But that in itself was actually, although it took longer to do the things, and also you had to plan your trip in the same way. If you wanted to buy a record, you'd have to wait till Saturday go on a bus or a train, or your parents drive you. And there was that to look forward to. Whereas today, today, you could literally just go into your phone, press a button, and you can listen to it. And although it's more accessible, something to my mind is lost in that process. And I don't know whether you can just have too much access, too ready access to things that takes away the whole process of anticipation. Or maybe I'm just looking at that through the lens of what I'm used to, and my own children, when they're older, will have a different sort of set of contours.
Yeah, I think it's very age specific. Yeah. So it was very important to say your first record, and you go and buy a record, and records were expensive, so they were really, really precious, whereas that is gone now. Although it's coming back, but I mean, I moved with, when I immigrated to Zimbabwe, I took all my records with me and I kept them. Then my husband, who although having grown up on a completely different part of the world, we had a very similar taste in music. So we had a very vast record collection that in the end, I think when we moved to Botswana, because when I say we moved to Botswana, we virtually fled to Botswana and we had to leave most of our things behind. But the records came to Botswana. Yeah. It's when we moved to England, when we left everything behind, that we then didn't have the records. And now I'm thinking, I wish I had them.
Yeah, and I bet, although in theory you could replace them, you wouldn't want to do that.
No.
Because I mean, in my office at work, I've got lots of old VHS videos that I bought in the 90s. But in a way, because every one of those is associated with a particular journey, a place, a time, to replace them wouldn't, it wouldn't have the same cachet.
So records were left behind. We did bring some cassette tapes, but they have now sadly mostly broken. And we took some CDs. We have got, and those we started buying again. And we have got stacks and boxes and boxes full of CDs. Yeah. And both have a CD player in our car and still listen to CDs.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you replace books, I brought some books along.
Yeah, it's funny because I read a lot on Kindle if I can. And so it's funny that I still like the hard copy films.
Mm.
But when it comes to books, I'm happy to read a digital version. I don't know why. It seems back to front because, you know, some of my colleagues will say, oh, there's nothing better than the smell of a new book. And I'm thinking, I suppose so. But if it's a book from 30 years ago, then yes. But if it's something new where you don't have that same sense of association, then I've got no problem investing in a new format.
Mm. Yeah, I've got both. I've got I don't have a Kindle. I've got an e-reader, a Dutch Sony thing again. And my mom sends me the e-books that she gets. But I only use it when I travel, because I used to travel quite extensively. Yeah. Of course, that hasn't happened for the last year and a half. But I like a real book. So at home, I will read real books. And I give them away, once I finish. Some of them I keep. I read a lot of thrillers and easy books, because during term time, I don't have the mental capacity to read something challenging. And those ones I've read them, I pass on to someone else. But when I travel, I'll take my e-reader with me.
And of course, the obvious question would be, what inspired you to enter your profession? Because I always find it very interesting when I work with colleagues sometimes, and you know them as work colleagues, but you don't know the other things going on in their life necessarily. Actually, during these interviews, I've learned far more about people through doing an interview. And I think, I knew you for 10 years. Now I realise I didn't know you at all. But in your case, so how did you end up working as a teacher?
Really. I wanted to be a ballerina, so completely different, and went to ballet school, and that was going to be my future. Then my knees packed up when I was 15. That was the end of that. Didn't know what I wanted to do, so after secondary school, I decided to do something with children. I used to babysit, but I wasn't the typical girl that wants to be a teacher. Never, ever. The thought had never, ever entered my mind. I studied social educational care. Did that for 4 years. So I got my bachelor's degree in that. And after that, I really enjoyed that. It was very interesting. I worked with, we call them stage, like an internship. Mm-hmm. I worked in a psychiatric institution, I worked with handicapped children, lots of different things, and decided I wanted to study some more. So I did my master's degree in pedagogy, and then I ended up in Africa. So couldn't really do much with my degree there, and I ended up in the fashion industry there, and I was became a menswear buyer for a very large chain of something a bit like Woolworths. Did that for a while, and then I had my first son, stayed at home for a while, and then when he had to go to nursery school, he was extremely shy, and in Zimbabwe they do that at 2.5, so I started working at the nursery school so that he would go, otherwise he just wouldn't go. And then I thought, well, actually, this is quite interesting. What do I want to do? So I then did my degree in teaching in with the University of South Africa. And that's how I got into it. So it wasn't a little girl's dream. I always wanted to become a teacher. It really sort of life...
And in some ways it's better because many of my students go into teaching profession and I'm always writing references, but some of them will say, you know, I want to do a degree in religious studies because I want to be a teacher, and they were inspired by their A-level teacher, etc. But it's always interesting when you've got the person who's like, well, I'm, you know, keeping my options open, and it's always interesting because even if you want to be a teacher from a young age or whatever it is, it's always interesting to see that along the way. I mean, in my case, from a young age, because I used to do all that, you know, listen to the radio, I was thinking, oh, I want to do that. And in a way, that sort of dream has never left me. And I think, you know, during the podcast...
You made me a clerk.
Yeah, and I realise it's sort of 30 years on. I'm kind of living that dream, but it in a different sort of guise. But that circuitous route I find interesting, that it's very easy, though, isn't it, to look back and find a pattern and say, ah, oh, well, yes, this, you know, I'm in this job now, and therefore that's always what I, you know, was destined to do. But actually, in reality, it's fascinating to join all those dots and also to wonder what you might have done. Of course, it could have been a ballerina.
Yeah.
You know, what you would have done if the cards had been stacked differently. Yeah.
Well, so I worked in the fashion industry for a couple of years, and I did really well in it, but I just found it so, you know, people got their knickers in a knot over the cost of the colour of a drawstring on the inside of a pair of tracksuit bottoms. Like, seriously? Are you really making a big deal about this? Yeah. So it wasn't something that I felt was, for me, it wasn't worthwhile. I thought, you know, I'm not going to have sleepless nights over. Yeah. If the shirt has to have 5 buttons or 6 or, you know, things like that, or does this pattern suits that one. That was a job.
Yeah.
I was good at it, but it didn't, you know, didn't set the world on fire. It didn't inspire me.
It's interesting, isn't it, in terms of skill sets, because, and I say this to the students sometimes, and actually, if I'm honest, I'm also telling myself this, because, you know, some students are frightened of standing up in front of class, but they want to be teachers. But often they make the best teachers because they overcome that obstacle that standing in front of a class is very daunting. But they also know they have to do it. And then they find ways around that, sometimes quite creative ways of doing it. And it's so interesting sometimes that it's that disconnect between a dream, but knowing that you're not, at this moment in time anyway, able to fulfil it. But then you accumulate a skill set, maybe working, say, in retail or whatever it might be. And then, you know, you sometimes think, well, actually, this is actually a really good thing to have in terms of being able to engage with teachers or parents, whatever it might be. So it's interesting along the way that sometimes from a completely different part of your life, you've got the means to be able to deal with something that perhaps gives you a certain uniqueness of perspective. But it's come from something where you could never have imagined that you could have gone from A to B with that kind of trajectory.
Yeah, I think it's really important for teachers to have a broader experience than just the classroom, because there is so much more out there. And to realise that, you know, you're dealing with parents who might come from a very high-pressured job, or it gives you an insight, a bigger insight into what goes on around it, because being a teacher is not just the classroom. That's a very small part of it.
Yeah.
There is so much more that goes into it. And if you haven't really got any life experience, that can be really difficult because you can then not always see the other side. Same with being a parent. I think once you're a parent yourself, it is easier or you can understand the parents better. I find sometimes teachers who don't have children, they think, well, but they're parents, they're making such a big deal about this. Yeah. Like, yeah, I know for you it's not a big deal, but I understand where they're coming from, because if that was my child, I would also be upset, and it might not be accurate. But I can understand.
Yeah. No, I think that you put that brilliantly, because I'm thinking of how in my own profession sometimes it's important not to forget that, you know, I was a student once. I was a school pupil once. So it's easy. I've got some, you know, colleagues who might say things like, oh, you know, that the students are always expecting things and, you know, they're interfering with my research and so on. But you're thinking, yeah, but how would you have felt 30 or whatever years ago when you needed something and you needed someone there for you? And maybe you entered the profession because there was somebody inspirational. And so in a way, are you that inspirational person for your students? And I think sometimes that sense, and you obviously you can't compare what professions change and that the needs and the demands from 30 years ago are not going to be the same as now. But I think in terms of just that human person-to-person contact, it's vital.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think the more experience you've got, mm-hmm. and the wider the range of experiences you have, the better you can deal with people.
And what about teachers who inspired you, whether at school or university?
I don't know if there was anyone that particularly inspired me. I had some good teachers and I had some not so good teachers. I've got teachers looking back that I think, oh my goodness, that was allowed. You know, you wouldn't get away with it now. So no, there wasn't anyone particularly inspirational, I don't think. There's teachers I remember. But no, I had a music teacher who was, this was at secondary school. I think he really, I'm not musical at all. I love listening to music, can't play an instrument or anything like that. And he made it interesting and fun and he made you think. So there were a few like that, but I wouldn't say anyone stood up particularly.
Because I always wonder, when I'm teaching my students, who am I channeling? Because sometimes, and it may be because I'm teaching a similar topic that I was taught at university or school, whatever, and you're thinking also of the performance element as well. It's not just the content, but also I think sometimes you might be channeling something from, you know, maybe somebody you look up to. It might be a presenter or a sports person or something, but somehow that it's that kind of enthusiasm that you're channeling in your work. And I always find that really interesting because you're sometimes aware of it. You're standing in front of a class of people and you think, when I was, you know, their age, you know, when I was sitting there looking at the tutor, I would have thought that the most difficult thing in the world would be to stand up and engage an audience. And yet now I do that every day. But whenever I find myself in the student's role, if ever I'm sitting at somebody else's talk, I find that I get a bit restless, my mind wanders.
Yes.
And I think, but I teach for up to two, three hours. I just stand there and I talk and I've got, and I get more and more energy. So it's easier to stand in front of to be at the front of the class than it is to be in the class. And that for me is one of the most interesting lessons. It's much easier to be a teacher than a pupil.
Absolutely. We did, this was during lockdown and I was interviewing for a teacher. Now, I never ever appoint if I haven't seen someone teach, because that is the most important thing. And you can see very, very quickly if someone can or can't. But of course, during lockdown, we couldn't do that. So we interviewed a teacher and asked him to, well, there was a three or four teachers, and we asked them to prepare an activity, and they came, this was at Mouthy School, so it was a much bigger school, bigger classroom, so they were in front of the classroom, and we were sitting right at the back, so myself, my deputy, and the class teachers, it was three of us, and they had to sort of pretend that we were the kids, and I reverted straight back to being the chatty, cheeky one, not listening, you know. Where my deputy, really funny, she was the real goody two-shoes. And when we were talking about it later on, that's how she'd been in school, and that was really how I've been in school. And it was quite funny because, I feel my attention goes.
Well, there's a funny story, because I'm not naming names here, but we were interviewing a few weeks ago for a lectureship and doing the same thing. We had to be the pupils. Yeah. And one of the other colleagues had to share the screen and forgot that they were sharing the screen on behalf of the candidate. And while they were talking, they said, well, just because obviously we have emails going on all the time. And they thought, I'll just check that. And of course, suddenly the emails came up on the screen and it was hilarious. What it was. But actually, it actually made the session even better, because suddenly the person doing the talk, you know, was given a real life situation to deal with.
Yes.
So rather than just talking into the ether, you know, in the same way sometimes, you know, if a dog barks or if suddenly somebody, especially if you're like a heckler at a rally, sometimes they're staged. I've been at concerts and you know that person, you know, when they heckle at a certain point, that's all part of the act. And of course it brings out the best in the person. So in a funny way, you're right that doing something online is different, but there are ways of still managing to gauge, you know, whether somebody can still communicate.
Yeah, because it's important. You can't, you know, especially, again, at primary school level, you know, you have to be engaging. You have to, you have to be able to teach it the right stuff, but you have to deal with the pupils, with the students, and you have to deal with situations that are just completely bizarre, and you can't make them up, because you'll be in the middle of a lesson and one of the children will say, well, there's a dead hedgehog lying in the corner there. You know, deal with it. Or hear dead crows, foxes, you know, anything happens. But deal with it.
Yeah, and of course, yes, actually that happened to me at work once, where there were some, there may have been rabbits, and they were inside a bin. You know, an outdoor bin. Well, of course, I'm assuming they were rabbits, because there were rabbits around. But there was no way I was going to, you know, investigate them. Because then in the back of my mind, I was thinking, what if it's a child? It wasn't. I knew it couldn't be a child. But then you're thinking, if I ignore it, and then it turns out there's been some horrible, you know, disaster, I could have done something. So I remember phoning our estates team and having to say, this is going to sound like very odd. And they were like, this is the strangest request we've ever had. But, you know, I had to do that. Yeah. It could have been a cat. It could have been, I didn't know. I didn't want to hang around, to be honest, because, you know, I thought I'd hear some scratching and I hear some, you know, yelping and so on. But there must be some really odd experiences that you look back on. And because I find with my own children, they see things through a completely different lens. And often they really get something. They sort of, whereas with adults sometimes, you know, you have to, you're often very strategic in what you say and do. But children just come out with it sometimes. And you think, how at your young age are you able to say, you know, where do these pearls of wisdom come from? But you must have found that with children. And like, you know, how do you really know what's going on?
It's both. Sometimes they come up with really, really sharp, you know, they come out and think, yeah, how do you know that? Nine times out of ten, they don't really know, but what they've said has just nailed it right on the head. But the more funny ones is where they say something that is so, they don't know what they've said or what they've pointed out, but all the adults in the room just go, oh my God, okay, that's really funny. Yeah. That happens quite a lot. And we're not allowed to share those things with parents. So sometimes they draw pictures and we go, because they're really funny.
And those are the things you see in films sometimes when the parents, who of course think that their children are amazing and wonderful, and the teachers are like, there's obviously a bit macabre going on. Why are they drawing these very sort of grotesque pictures? And they're like, oh, that my child couldn't have done that. I said, are you sure? Yeah. And then of course, you know, all the layers are peeled.
It's when, because this happens quite a lot. You know, parents will take their children on holiday when they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And they tell the children to say this, that, or the next thing. Don't bother, because children will always tell the truth.
Yeah.
And if they don't, their friends will, because they don't know that they shouldn't be saying these things.
Yeah. No, I can imagine, and I'm not asking you a question here, but I can easily imagine during lockdown that some interesting breach, and I'm not, I don't mean in this school, but I'm thinking generally of the ways in which sometimes people go places or do things, and you think, technically, we wouldn't encourage that.
Yes.
Yeah, say no more. As we start to wrap up, I always ask at this point some more sort of philosophically based questions. You know, are your memories predominantly positive as you survey your life and career?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yes. Because the converse of that is, and I think we touched on this already about some of the, you know, the horrible, debilitating experiences that you witnessed in Africa and so on. But can you be nostalgic about a negative experience? You know, when you sort of have that level of reflection on something that happened, because it turned out all right in the end, you might think, well, actually, it was a good learning experience. But I always try and work out, because because nostalgia is, you know, my area of research, and yes. I'm thinking, you know, people sometimes say to me, is nostalgia a positive thing or a negative thing? And it's kind of, it's both. It's bitter. It's bittersweet because there's that sense of something missing, and you can pine for it, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if you're longing for something, you're yearning for it, but it isn't there, but it was there once. But do you think it will ever come back? Do you want to rebuild it? Or is it just there in the imagination and you just have to deal with it? But did you have any of those sort of reflections?
Yeah, I think, you know, we sit and we talk about the past and, you know, friends we've had who've, and family have passed away and good times we've had. And I think that is nostalgia. I would say that is part of it. And we've had some really, really good times during some horrendous or really good experience during a horrendous time. So no, it's not always negative and it's not always positive. Negative things have happened. We've had really negative experiences. But because you've come through the other side, they're okay. Yeah. And sometimes, actually, in hindsight, quite funny. Whereas at the point that they happened, they were not.
Yeah, and I'm thinking as well in terms of, because obviously it's easy from an outside perspective for me to think that, you know, what you had to deal with in Zimbabwe is, you know, I can't imagine how you dealt with that. And yet, I suppose, although you're, you know, in a beautifully serene part of Kent, and it's you know, a complete, you know, a different sort of world. And yet, when you're dealing with the pupils and the parents and their issues, so there must be times when you sort of sometimes think that sort of comparison of what happened when you were in that trouble spot and where you are now, but also recognising that even if you're not in a war zone, that doesn't mean to say that your life is amazing and wonderful and balanced.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I do sometimes think, you know, really, are you really making a fuss about that? You know, you should, you really shouldn't. But however, to those people, that is a big thing, and you need to acknowledge that. I think sometimes I can just be a bit more level-headed and say, okay, well, you know, it's not the end of the world. Yeah. Let's try and see what we can do to sort it out.
Yeah. And do you find that you often draw on those experiences, or is that something that's kind of quite private in terms of Africa? Is that a part that you share quite readily, or is that sometimes
not something
that you bracket out?
It's feels like a long time ago, a lifetime ago, and especially now since the pandemic, it feels like two lifetimes ago. It comes up in conversations sometimes, and people go, oh, really? Because they don't know. I think when we first came here, it was very much still a big part of our lives. We've moved on.
And I think I touched on this question earlier, but are you in touch with friends from your past and family, for that matter? Because we mentioned social media. I mean, you know, what would we have done before Facebook? But
I know. Yeah. Well, this is my brother passed away when he was 29. That's quite a long time ago now. And things like Facebook, I was living in Zimbabwe, and we still had dial-up connections. Yeah. And you know, if someone sent you three photographs in an email, it took a week to download and probably blocked everything up. Yeah. We were like that for quite a lot longer than people were here. And that's what I think, you know, if that had existed then, we would have been able to be in contact so much more in the last couple of months of his life, where what we did was it was a once-a-week phone call. Yeah. That was all we had.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because my parents are not online at all. I mean, my dad recently turned 80. And they are really, it's frustrating in some ways because it means that you can't do what everyone else does, which is to share pictures.
Yes.
But so I have old-fashioned phone calls, but because I've done that all my life with them. Of course, you speak to them separately on the phone. So I speak to my mum for however long, then my dad, and often have the same sort of conversations.
Yes.
But these days, of course, we do everything, you know, you'll teach with online with all the pupils at the same time. So it's very interesting, but not a bad thing to still have those sort of residues because you know, that's a reminder of how things always used to be.
Yes.
And no matter how great technology moves on and the way that we do things professionally, sometimes that's a good reminder. It's no bad thing having a reminder sometimes of you know, where we've come from, because if you know where you've come from, you have some inkling of where you might be going to.
I used to write letters all the time. So because initially I was only going to go to Africa for about 6 months. I ended up living there for 15 years. Yeah. So, and I used to write like a weekly letter, which I would send to my mom, and she would photocopy them at work and then sent them on to grannies and friends, and so that everybody had that, and then they would write back. And because the mail took so long, there was always a huge overlap. But when my grandmother passed away, she passed away just after she turned 100, so she did really well. One of the things I was given was a portfolio with all those letters. Now, I didn't have them anymore, but she had kept all of them, and that was really interesting to get back. I don't know how we got to that bit, but there's writing letters. But no one writes letters anymore.
No, and because I did the same as you, I always wrote letters to my parents, but my parents have kept everything, and I always keep everything. And because I've, as I got a diary, what I've done, when I've got time, is go back over and actually write them up, as I do everything digitally, but, write up those letters that correspond then with when they were written. So I might have a very short diary entry from, 1993, but then there might be a reference to, wrote a letter to mum and dad, but now I've got that letter, so I'll flesh it out. And that's an interesting journey. So you can, because people have said to me something like, do you know when, in the university where I was, there were some floods one year, and we were like, oh, do you know when they were? And I was able to piece it all together through the combination of letters and diaries and other sort of footage. And people were like, oh, how did you do that? And it was like a bit of detective work. But I kind of liked the fact that, because I went through something, very, very minor, it was just literally the banks of the river were going to flood the student union one evening. It's like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We went to get our beer. But because that happened, it was very interesting in terms of trying to then work out whether our memories are completely faulty or distorted. And I think generally I was able to piece it together, but it's an interesting exercise to almost like treat your life as a bit of to be a detective in your own life story investigation.
I didn't keep diaries. I've got letters and I've got bits and pieces from my first year or so in Africa.
No, that's brilliant though that you had all of those, and wonderful as well. So your grandmother passed away and had kept all of this. So the question that I guess is, what are you going to do with all of that?
Well, I don't know. It's just sitting there at the moment in a box, and I haven't even read through all of them. I suppose I will at some point.
You have to do it when the time is right, because because also the amount of investment and also emotional investment in something that you there will be a time when it's right to do that, but you can't just artificially just go in and say, oh, I'm just going to read through all of this, because that's just going to exhaust you.
My eldest son, he's now learning. He's learning Dutch, and he's quite good at it now. So I think at some point he'll be able to read them. That'd be quite interesting.
Well, my very last question.
Yeah.
Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Looking forward kind of person.
Not a bit of both, or
a little bit of looking back, but not too much. I don't really believe in the what if, if I, you know, you didn't. This is the path that you're on, this is what happened. And there are lessons there, I suppose, but you use them for going ahead. You always look, my husband always said, you're always like looking three steps ahead of, once we've done this, then we can do this, and then we can go over there. Just take it easy, always planning ahead.
Well, Babish, it has been wonderful to catch up with you. We've covered so much ground. So thank you for being my guest this week.